There's that old line we may remember from our childhoods, good night, sleep tight, don't let the bed bugs bite. Well, that's a line that's always given me some pause. It's hard to think of sleeping tight if indeed bed bugs are sharing the sheets. But the fact is, there are scads of bugs out there. Humankind has had to coexist with bugs for millennia. Roaches and locusts, fleas and mosquitoes. They may be small in size, but they have had big impacts on human history, often through disease and destruction. We're thinking here about the plague, malaria, famine. But insects do have a beneficial role in the grand scheme of things, too. Imagine, if you will, a world without honey or figs, or piles of dead bodies and trash we'd have to wade through without insects to do the decomposing. The lowly maggot has even been used to help heal human wounds. The annual Bug Fest is happening in Raleigh this weekend, and so we're taking a closer look at bugs today. Which of the insects out there would you defend if you could? Which North Carolina insect would you prefer we just did without? And what is it about bugs? Even if you hear about all the good they can do, what is it about bugs that there's that impulse to, well, squash it like a bug? Our number's 1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862. We are joined today by two advocates of the insect world. Josie Glauzius is an editor at Discovery Magazine and author of the book Buzz, The Intimate Bond Between Humans and Insects. Welcome to The State of Things.
Hi.
Hi. And Bill Reynolds is back with us. He is curator of the Anthropod Zoo at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. Welcome back, Bill.
Thank you.
And we should say that you've brought part of the zoo with you here today.
Yes, I have a few friends that I brought with me, and unfortunately on radio people won't be able to see them, but we can talk about them.
Sure, and maybe we can hear from them in just a moment or two. But first, let's talk about bugs. And Josie, I imagine you think that bugs get a bad rap.
Well, yes. I think that many people don't really consider how truly essential insects are to human existence. Insects pollinate about 80% of the world's 94 major food crops. They decompose the dead. They decompose dead plant matter. Ants also aerate the soil. They bring nutrients down from the surface. And insects are very important predators of pests. So next time you think about, you know, taking out the bug spray, think about that.
So you're saying some insects will eat other insects?
Yes.
Okay.
And also they're important food for many birds, many mammals, many lizards, and of course humans eat them too.
Mm-hmm. I guess the trick for a lot of us humans might be then to decide which ones are beneficial, which ones would eat the other bugs, and which would be a threat, a direct threat to us.
Yes, well, I mean, of course, I mean, just think about the mosquito. I mean, the mosquito is, you know, transmits malaria in many parts of the world. But actually, I have to say that mosquitoes also play their part in the web of life, mm-hmm. because many animals eat mosquitoes. They're important food for dragonflies, damselflies. I just like to think of insects being part of this great web of life, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Of course, there are certain things that we probably would rather not live closely with. But
Right. So why is it, Bill, I guess you maybe have had to field this question over time. Why is it that people generally are afraid of bugs? They recoil at them.
Oh, I think it's a combination of things. One, probably the novelty factor and lack of knowledge about them as a life form. People tend to fear things they don't understand. And I think that there's also a cultural component, particularly in our culture, that has taught us from the time that we're small to avoid things such as insects. They tend to be portrayed as bad, as an element of danger.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We are talking today about bugs. With us are Josie Glauzius, who is author of Buzz, The Intimate Bond Between Humans and Insects, and Bill Reynolds, who is curator of the Anthropod Zoo at the North Carolina Museum of Sciences, where there will be the North Carolina Bug Fest this weekend. We welcome your calls. What bug is it that you just need to be persuaded it needs to exist and coexist with you? The number's 1-877-962-9862. All of that is just ahead on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penkava, and today We are talking about bugs. The North Carolina Bug Fest is happening in Raleigh this weekend. With us is Bill Reynolds. He is curator of the Arthropod Zoo at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, where the Bug Fest is happening. And Josie Glazius is an editor at Discover Magazine and author of the book Buzz, The Intimate Bond Between Humans and Insects. And they're making the case that bugs are more beneficial than many of us might think. I think when a fly or a wasp comes near you, you just want to swat it away and wish it dead. But they're making the case that bugs have a real important role to play for humankind. Once again, the number is 1-877-962-9862. I want to talk about one of the bugs that you have in your book, which has rather very much enlarged pictures of these bugs, very artful, but they might give some pause about sleeping well at night knowing that these are there. You make the case for the maggot.
Yes.
This is the larval stage of the fly.
Yes.
It's something you generally, you don't want to have near you.
Yes.
But as you write in this book, Josie Glazius, they have been used over time to heal human wounds.
Yes, that's true. There was a 16th century doctor called Ambroise Poire who found, he was a battlefield surgeon, and he noticed that when soldiers' wounds were infested with maggots, they healed much faster and more cleaner than soldiers whose wounds were not infested. And he realized that, in fact, what was happening was that the maggots are eating only dead flesh. They don't eat live flesh. And so this was a very good way of healing soldiers' wounds. And in the 20th century, this was used first in the early part of the 20th century, but also it's very much used nowadays, for example, for healing diabetic ulcers, where antibiotics often don't work.
So in other words, you write in this book that there was a time in the 1940s mm-hmm. when several hundred hospitals in the U.S. used this maggot therapy.
Yes.
But then we had antibiotics, and
yes.
they came in, but we have people who may be there may be a resistance to antibiotics.
There's a lot of antibiotic resistance around nowadays, and antibiotics just often don't work. I mean, diabetes is a really terrible disease, and sometimes, often this is used as the last resort, but I've actually seen it being used, and the people who use it often are very grateful because they've had no other recourse up to that point.
So how does this work, though? So in hospitals in America now, this may be used. Where
yes.
maggots
not
are
everywhere, but...
yes, in those very rare cases where the antibiotics don't.
Yeah.
So how does a person sit still? Can they feel these bugs on them going to work on that wound?
Well, often the flesh that they're eating is dead, so often they really don't have any sensation anyway. And basically, the wound is wrapped with a bandage. The maggots are inside the bandage, and they sort of go to work. They leave them there for maybe, I think, 48 hours, and then they take them off, and often they put another batch on. But I've heard great reports about it.
Okay. 1-877-962-9862 is our number. We go to Chris, who's in Chatham County. Hi there, Chris.
Hello.
Greetings. Did you have a question for Josie or Bill?
Well, sure, I do. My wife and I moved actually from Massachusetts down here about a year and a half ago. Bought a wonderful property in the country, and then shortly after we're diagnosed with Lyme disease, both of us.
Wow.
So yeah, real fun.
Which is caused by the tick.
Yes. Lyme disease and actually a couple other co-infections. So actually earlier this spring we had two gentlemen from NC State come out, and they're doing a study on Lyme and some other things. So they collected ticks on our property, and in about an hour they walked around the property dragging for ticks and got about 70 just right around our house. Often when I go out, for instance, just to put stuff in our compost pile, I'll come back with one of these guys on her. So obviously, knowing our position, we're kind of interested in reducing the numbers. We have obviously, we have just deer come running amok, and that's what I'm told is the real problem is the deers. But anyway, so what can we do to do ticks actually help us in any manner? And B, what can we do to reduce the numbers without killing everything else?
Okay, let's go to the defense team here for ticks. Bill Reynolds?
Oh, goodness, asking me to defend ticks. That's a hard one. Ticks do serve a function, and the function, they're a food item for a lot of animals, including other arachnids, insects, birds, mammals. There are things that eat ticks. There's kind of a perversity to it also. Many animals that vector diseases are also an integral part of population control. By vectoring diseases that actually keep populations of other animals under control.
When you speak of vectoring, for a layperson,
that would refer to actually an organism that carries a virus or a bacterial or a protozoan parasite or agent that causes a disease. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult for us as humans to wrap our minds around it, but disease in many respects in populations is an element of population control. Mm-hmm. And it is hard to defend, but it's an element of reality.
Right. But Chris in Chatham County would not like to have...
He would not like to be the target
of population control.
Oh, absolutely. And I couldn't agree with him more. This is a problem where, you know, anytime man enters the edge of wilderness, which many of us desire to do, we like to live away from the hub of human population. It's just another obstacle that we have to learn to live with. It's the same as if you live in the inner city crossing the street.
What can he do to reduce his exposure to them other than moving from near the edge of the woods?
Avoid the times of day or year that they're most active and most abundant. Definitely anytime you're out in the field and out and about in areas where you know ticks occur, frequently check yourself behind the ears, just all over for any tick that may be on you or attached to you, and remove it as soon as possible. And if you live in an area where you know that ticks exist and you know you've been bitten by ticks, keep in contact with your doctor, have tests and checks run periodically.
I have heard of people who spray their yards for that. And I know you're not an advocate of chemical spraying, but that is something that people do.
It is something that can be implemented to control to a point, but it's a very overall it's a very ephemeral control. It's something that requires repeated treatment. It's constant, and the sum total accumulation of such chemicals in the environment has a greater negative impact not only on the ticks that you're targeting, but everything else, and even potentially people.
One final question on this subject, and that is, every month I put Frontline on my dog and cat,
so
that they don't get the fleas and ticks. Is there any such thing that humans who are living on the edge there can do?
You know, I've often thought about it myself because I live in the country, southern Wake County, and I do the front line on my dogs. And, yeah, I've oftentimes thought, I'll just pop one and put it on me too. But unfortunately, no, there isn't.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Chris, good luck with that. Thank you for your call. There is a vaccine being developed, or they're trying to, that you write about in your book, Jesse.
Yes, and it's based on actually tick saliva. There's some researchers at the University of Rhode Island who are trying to make a vaccine to this tick saliva, and they've developed a method of collecting tick saliva. They claim they have more tick saliva than any other research team in the world.
So is it the saliva that passes along the disease?
Well, when the tick bites the human, they are injecting saliva into the wound. So if you can give the body a defense against the saliva, then you have a small chance of fending off the disease. I don't know how effective this is at this point. I think it's quite experimental.
I did read with interest that in your book that the way that they get this tick saliva from the ticks is to apply a muscle relaxant.
Yes, it makes them drool.
Oh, okay. Right. Drooling ticks. If you have a question about any bug out there, our number is 1-877-962-9862. Mary is in Moore County. Hi there, Mary.
Hi. I wanted to ask about praying mantis, because last summer we had a very large female, about 3.5 to 4 inches long, sitting on a hummingbird feeder, stalking my hummingbirds. And I didn't know if that was like a normal sort of behavior.
Well, if she mistakes the hummingbird for a male praying mantis, that hummingbird doesn't have a chance. But Bill?
Actually, it is. It is here in the eastern U.S. It is quite common. The large mantis you're referring to is actually the Chinese mantis, and they were introduced into the United States quite a number of decades ago as an agent of pest control in gardens. And since then, they have become a part of our fauna and have adapted to a wide range of habitats, particularly those that are peripheral to our own, such as residential areas and even within cities. And unfortunately, for hummingbirds, there has never been an insect predator like the Chinese mantis that has since been introduced to avoid. All of our indigenous mantids are considerably smaller. Mm-hmm. And Chinese mantids simply mistake a small bird for something like a large moth.
Now, do you have an example of that?
I do, actually. I have a living Chinese mantis with me.
And we don't have a hummingbird in the studio.
No.
So, that is large. That is longer than, that is almost 6 inches long. 5 to 6, right?
They can vary anywhere from about 4 to 6 inches long. And
yeah.
As you can see, the first pair of legs are raptorial. That means grabbing.
Yes.
It's a predator. And you take something as small as a hummingbird, a large insect like this could readily grab it.
Really. Mm-hmm. And kill it.
Oh, absolutely. And kill it and eat it. And as you can see, she's looking around right now at the room, seeing all of us talk and move. But no, this is very common. I've heard about it in at least 4 different states, and as far as I had mentioned it earlier, even in conversation, mantids getting on hummingbird feeders and stalking the hummingbirds.
And this is another case of introducing a species here, an exotic species, with the idea that this would do good for agriculture. I guess the praying mantis do eat.
They're voracious predators, but they don't target specific things. They target whatever moves and whatever draws their attention. It's and you know, if it's viewed as prey, they seize it.
Mm-hmm. And we have some Madagascar hissing cockroaches in the studio, and it's eyeing them very.
Two cages away, it seems.
Yes.
One other question about the praying mantis. One always hears of how the female praying mantis, after mating with a male, will kill him, eat his head, devour him. Mm-hmm. Why does she do that?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I recently came across some information that seems to suggest that it's something we view in captivity more often than probably occurs in the wild. Again, like I said, they're predatory animals. The female eating the male is not essential to their reproductive success. And different species of mantids will behave differently. But there was some indication that a lot of this information about the females eating the males is based on what we've observed in controlled conditions, which may not necessarily reflect what's going on in nature.
Really? So in other words, by just caging them, it could maybe cause a reaction.
You have
like
to
that.
Bear in mind, any time an animal is caged, it's at the whims of the keeper as of how frequently it eats. Mm. You give a female mantis in a flower garden, and she can pretty much be satiated a pretty good percentage of the time.
Mm. So that could be a myth, perhaps, or just a misconception?
I think probably more of a misconception that's reinforced by the fact that it occurs.
Okay. And as for Mary and her praying mantis stalking the hummingbirds, what could she do if she wants to help the hummingbirds survive?
Just keep an eye out for the mantids. When they get near the hummingbird feeder, remove them. Just put them out in the garden.
And they won't hurt her?
No.
They can
pinch, but you know, if you take down the hummingbird feeder or poke it with a stick, they usually fly off.
Okay. Mary, thank you for your call. 1-877-962-9862 is our number. That's 1-877-962-9862. Sarah is in Chase County in Virginia. Welcome, Sarah.
Hi. I have free-range hens. And I've noticed in all my friends, you know, anybody that has them, says they are great for bug control. And you just let them run around the yard, and they get the ticks and they get the chiggers. That's what I've noticed. The only problem is keeping the hens alive, keeping the foxes from getting them when you live too close to the woods. But, you know, I have a hen house that they go to at night, and I lock them up. And I have heard stories of the chickens actually picking ticks off of your goats or your sheep. But I haven't seen that myself.
Wow. Well, maybe that's a solution for Chris in Chatham County, is to get a couple of chickens.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no doubt that chickens, again, going back to birds feeding on such things, birds have acute vision, and they notice the slightest movement. And chickens, yeah, they spend almost all of their time picking and pecking and eating. Mm-hmm. So certainly they will reduce bug control or serve as an element of bug control. And I've even heard of them controlling Japanese beetles.
And so if the chicken were to eat a tick that was carrying the Lyme disease, would the chicken contract it, or no? Is it just something that
I
we
think
humans
you
are
have
susceptible
to be bitten by?
Yes.
It.
Okay, but just ingesting the saliva of the tick. It
basically, it's just digested.
Okay. So, okay. Yeah. Well, Sarah, thanks for the suggestion. 1-877-962-9862. Kevin is in Saxapaha. Hi there, Kevin.
Hello. My question is about the American black soldier fly, and this is that quick darting blue fly, almost looks like a wasp that you see around your compost piles and whatnot. It might even be the blue tail fly of the Jimmy Crack Corn Song. But
does it bite? Does it bite humans?
No, it actually doesn't bite. It's a very it tends to avoid humans.
Okay.
Lives in the wood. It's a primary digesting fly. Anyway, we use the fly around our farm to digest farm waste, and we're hearing that it has great potential of manufacturing biodiesel fuel, digesting hog waste from the hog farms, even possibly digesting waste treatment plant waste from municipalities. How likely is insect technology, which is kind of low tech, to come to the forefront and actually start being used in lieu of maybe a more high-tech solution?
Okay.
I think that every day we are gravitating in that direction. A number of reasons. Again, like I said, chemicals, things like that, are costly. They're also, we're finding negative impacts of overuse of such things in the environment that not only affect us but our food sources and other things. And I think it's really a good idea, but it's still going to take time, research, and effort. And I'm familiar with this fly, but I'm not familiar with the information that you've just given us. It seems you're a little more knowledgeable on it than I am, at any rate.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There are also some other places where you write in your book, Josie, that humans are looking to the insect world and what they may have to offer. It almost sounded like there's a treatment of the insects as we would the rainforest. You know, we should go into the rainforest because there might be solutions to some medical problems.
Yeah.
And in bugs, mm-hmm. not just the maggots eating the bad wounds, but by taking some things out of bugs, we can perhaps find particles that might help.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, antibiotic resistance is a huge problem right now. And there are companies, one is in Strasbourg, I think one is in Australia, which are actually looking at insect blood. It's actually called hemolymph, but they're extracting the blood and they're testing substances in it to see if they have antibiotic potential. The one in Strasbourg, they've tested about 100 different insects which they've collected from all over the world. Insects do have a somewhat more primitive immune system than mammals, but one of the good things is about insect these particles is they think that the antibiotic resistance would be less likely to develop. The interesting thing about insects is they live in basically every environment on the planet except under the ocean. So they're adapted to a huge amount of huge range of things. I mean, they can live in petroleum pools. Mm-hmm. They live in waste. So they have to have a robust immune system in order to survive.
Well, there's one in the book, the wood louse.
Yes.
Which
is actually
bug,
not an insect.
Okay, a crustacean of sorts.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But there was it might have been that louse or a related bug. Yeah. That scavenges copper and other heavy metals,
yes.
and almost could be used as a detector
for industrial waste, yes.
for where ground's
yes.
contaminated.
Yes.
Could they also be used to clean it up?
Possibly, yes. Because they're scavenging not just copper out of the soil, but all kinds of heavy metals. So, yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. Suzanne is with us from Pleasant Garden. Hi there, Suzanne.
Hi.
Sounds like a very prosaic place.
Well, it's normally very pleasant, except that right now I'm covered in blisters and rashes from fire ants. And I'm just wondering, I never saw them on my body. And I was pulling weeds on Monday. And that's when they started to come up, and I never saw the ants, but I have this rash and blisters all over my body, and how would I not see them?
Bill?
Oh, I can address that very quickly. First and foremost, had you been bitten by fire ants, you would be well aware of the ants on you because the biting and the stinging is immediate, and you notice the insects. They're small, but they're not that small. And if you're covered with a rash, then you've encountered one of two things. I would think chiggers or potentially poison ivy, poison oak. The insects would be, especially fire ants, it's unpleasant, and you know when they're on you, and you know immediately when they're on you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Suzanne, maybe that helps you sleuth out what it is?
Well, I've seen the fire ants when I'm pulling up Bermuda grass, and they seem to be living underneath the pine needles in the roots of the Bermuda grass, which is why I assumed they were fire ants.
Usually fire ants construct rather large mounds that rise above the grass, and they readily attack anything that that violates the nest. So if you're pulling weeds, you would notice it would appear to be a large dirt mound. Do you have any such things in your yard?
Okay. Suzanne?
From other ants, maybe carpenter ants or something like that.
Carpenter ants aren't going to sting you.
Right.
Okay.
And what would be the benefits of the fire ants?
Well, they're an introduced species, so in our region of the world, probably not that many.
Right. You can't even make the case that other things would eat them?
Again, being an introduced species, they tend to outcompete a lot of our native ants.
Okay. All right. So if someone can make the case for the fire ant, we'd like to hear it. Our number is 1-877-962-9862. We'll continue our conversation with author Josie Glazius, who is the author of Buzz, The Intimate Bond Between Humans and Insects, and Bill Reynolds, who is curator of the Arthropod Zoo at the North Carolina Museum of History. What's a bug done for you lately? Our number is 1-877-962-9862. More coming up on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pankava. We're talking this hour about the role of insects in human life. And our number is 1-877-962-9862. If you have a question about bugs, how they're intersecting in your life through history, there have been insects involved with human life. Locusts mentioned in the book of Leviticus and the Quran, both as a bringer of plagues and an edible delicacy. Some insects, such as cockroaches and dust mites, depend on us to provide their homes and their food. And of course, there is the way that we depend on many others, such as bees and beetles and even wasps. Talking with us today are Josie Glazius, who is author of Buzz, The Intimate Bond Between Humans and Insects, and Bill Reynolds, who is curator of the Arthropod Zoo, the North Carolina Museum of Natural History in Raleigh, which is the site of this weekend's Bug Fest. The number is 1-877-962-9862. We have an email here from Fernando, who wants us to address the issue of yellow jackets. He says that yellow jacket stings appear to have increased markedly in the Triangle recently. He has several friends and colleagues stung by them, and they've had mild to severe reactions. One had to go to the emergency room in anaphylactic shock. And Fernando writes, although there are interesting biology and environmental issues about these creatures, they can be life-threatening and fatal, and they seem to be most active during midsummer and fall. And he would like you to make the case for the yellow jackets because of his experience with them as being a serious problem.
Well, I'd just like to point out, first of all, that yellow jackets are very important predator insects. So they eat farm pests. For example, they eat cabbage worms, which are an important pest. They're very important predator insects. And if we want to reduce our applications of pesticides, we need these kinds of insects because pesticides contaminate the environment and they also kill very useful insects. So it's something to think about. I mean, I always have to say that we have to think of ourselves as being part of this great web of life. I mean, unfortunately, people do get stung. I'm actually allergic to mosquito bites. Something you just have to put up with.
So what do you do about that if you're allergic to mosquito bites?
I take antihistamines, but yeah. I tend to swell up. It's kind of funny, actually, that I've written this book about how wonderful insects are. But
right. Well, as someone who has didn't realize that yellow jackets lived in the ground and once dug into the ground and got stung pretty badly, not going into shock, you know, the next thing we did was to destroy the nest because it was near a walkway at our house. We don't grow cabbage and don't have to worry about cabbage worms. So, Bill.
Well, in reference to what was said earlier, they are very important predators. Most of your paper wasps, your social wasps are. They actually forage rather large distances when you take the workers into consideration, their movements throughout the environment, seeking out prey items and then bringing it back and feeding it to the progeny. I last year had a yellow jacket nest in my yard, and you just have to, once you recognize it, my recommendation for most people is avoid the place where it is. And the more you agitate them, the more reactive they become to your presence. I can fully understand something on the edge of a walkway, but I discourage people from interacting in such a way that agitates them, and it certainly will reduce your chances or risks of getting stung.
Right. Well, make the case for wasps in general, because it's a rather broad category here, is it not?
Very broad.
Yeah. Now, there are wasps. Well, I think of them as wasps, the mud daubers.
Yes.
That's a wasp?
Okay. Yes, it is.
Then there's the paper wasps?
Yes.
Okay. But there's also the wasps that give us figs. If it weren't for them,
Fig trees are largely pollinated by wasps. Yeah. If we didn't have wasps, we wouldn't have figs. So,
how do they do that? Do they?
Well, pollination is basically the insect flies to. I mean, some flowers have female flowers and some have male, but I'm not quite sure what it is for the fig tree. But basically, they're taking inadvertently, for the most part, pollen from the male part of the flower and fertilizing the female part of the flower. That's how seeds develop. You know?
Right. And these are rather, as wasps go, these are rather tiny wasps, according to the photographs I've seen of them. that pollinate those figs. 1-877-962-9862 is our number. Marianne is in Durham. Hi, Marianne.
Hi. I live in Durham. Everywhere I've been in Durham is heavily infested with Asian tiger mosquitoes. I've done things like eliminate any possible source of water. Is there anything that I can do to control them?
The Asian tiger mosquito.
Encourage your neighbors and everyone you know to take on your own cultural practices of anything and everything that can hold water in your yard, keeping it inverted and empty. Mm-hmm. Bird baths, water dishes for pets, change the water out every couple days. Mm-hmm. It's not an easy thing to control. You're going to have knot holes in trees, you're going to have standing water on rooftops. So it's very difficult. But in immediate areas, it's really what you do in your yard isn't necessarily going to keep them out of your yard if your neighbors aren't taking on the same practices.
But there are mosquitoes also that don't necessarily need standing pools of water to live. If I understand, you know, they also would thrive very well, say, in a moist pine forest. It's almost more down on the coast of North Carolina. It seems like you're more likely to get, you know, stung by a mosquito if you're walking through pines than on the open water. And I've heard it's because the fish will eat the larvae on the open water, but in the pine forest, they can thrive.
You still have areas where there, you know, it doesn't take a whole lot of water, but you still have areas that are pretty moist where there may not be fish. And again, like I said, something as simple as a knot hole in a tree. You take a hollowed out tree that holds water, even if it holds it only for a matter of 10, 11, 12 days, you're giving more than enough time for a generation or two to be generated. So it doesn't necessarily require that you have ponds or roadside ditches.
Right, right. And of course, well, what mosquitoes, other than providing food for other critters, what role do they play in the grand scheme of things? Because they are the carriers of disease. I mean, we know people who get malaria, for instance, and West Nile virus now is a concern. Mm-hmm. Josie?
Well, I just have to go back to say that, you know, they are part of the web of life. Many fish eat them. Actually, fish can be used as very good biocontrol agents in rice paddies to take care of mosquitoes. Mm-hmm. Birds eat them. Other kinds of insects eat them. And then, there are animals that eat the birds and eat the fish. So, you know, if we may not like them, but, you know.
And you'd be amazed how many tons of them are eaten that never get a chance to bite you. That's what's so overwhelming. It's just the tip of the iceberg that we experience. And generally, our threshold for tolerance is one or two. I mean, you know, you sit out in the yard and one buzzes around you. But in actuality, there are lots of things that control them. And some male mosquitoes even function as pollinators.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
What do they pollinate?
Miscellaneous obscure plants that may in one way or another serve a function in the web of life.
Okay. You may have to come back and make the case for those miscellaneous obscure plants too. Okay. Karen is in Smithfield. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
Hi.
We have a pool in our backyard, and as soon as we get into the pool and start splashing around, I notice that horse flies come and sit on our heads and sometimes bite us. I'm wondering, are they attracted to water? Because I don't seem to notice them in the yard when I'm not inside the pool.
Horse flies. Any idea on that, Josie? No?
Slight idea. Part of my understanding is that they are attracted to contrast, dark and light. That's something I've read. As of the validity, I'm not 100% certain, but I have read that there is a contrast element. They also tend to like kind of open areas and what appears to be rather large food items. Hence, we call them horse flies. They seek out things such as deer, cows, horses, and humans. We fall in the category of being a pretty large mammal.
Right.
And I've often wondered the same thing. Why more so in a pool than not? Mm. But I think it's possibly the contrast.
Josie?
I just also want to make the point is that I'm often asked the question, you know, what good are bugs to us? What use are they? But I think we have to remember that insects were on this planet a long time before humans. I mean, insects evolved about 400 million years ago. Human beings, that is Homo sapiens, has been on this planet for about 100,000 years. So we really have to think about the fact that we're not there and they're not there for us. You know, they're not there to serve a purpose for us. They evolved, we evolved, but...
What about one critter that often gets mentioned about living forever and surviving a nuclear attack, the cockroach?
Yes.
Okay. What does the cockroach offer to the grand web?
Well, cockroaches are major decomposers where they... in rainforests, for example, they're major decomposers of rotting matter. I have to also say there is researchers at the University of California at Berkeley who are designing a robot that's based on a cockroach. It has six legs. It's called Rex. And they hope that one day that this robot will be able to rescue people from collapsed buildings, earthquakes, terrorist attacks.
So. Because of the very, and based on the cockroach, because the cockroach can seem to go anywhere?
The cockroach is designed, well, it evolved in a way that enables it to run very rapidly, and it's partly because it's very stable. Cockroaches also have kind of springs in their legs that enable them to run actually faster than they would otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Something that came out to me from your book that you wrote, and there are gorgeous photos in here from Volker Steger.
Yeah.
You write about the cockroach, and it brought to mind, years ago, I was reading about Archie the cockroach, who was this cockroach stuck in a typewriter, and he could never hit the cap key, so he always wrote in small case. Right? But in your book, you write that modern technology that roaches like the warmth they can find in electronic equipment. And I was sitting there at my keyboard thinking, oh, my gosh.
I actually opened my filing cabinet other day, and a cockroach ran out.
So they're drawn to the warmth there.
Yes, and they are actually, cockroaches are insects that have evolved in warm climates. In fact, I have heard it said that if humans were to go extinct, cockroaches would also disappear, certainly from the northern hemisphere, because we sort of provide them with a very comfy environment. It's a nice warm environment, lots of crumbs around. So, you know, if we weren't around, then, well, certainly in the northern hemisphere, we probably wouldn't have cockroaches either.
Mm-hmm. They do seem more prevalent the further south you go.
Oh, so, certainly.
Because I can, you know, I know that there are certainly cockroaches in the northeast, but it just doesn't seem to be, no matter how your housekeeping is done, you know, the house will get a cockroach.
Well, there are many, many different species of cockroaches. I think that's an important thing to point out. Not all species of cockroaches are home invading. It tends to be that handful of species, like the German cockroach, the American cockroach, that are home invading, and not just invading, but establish themselves and proliferate in our environment. Mm. Those are oftentimes problematic. People find that when they move to the south and you encounter larger roaches, more numerous roaches, many of these are more house invading than house infesting.
So they just happen to come in and go out.
Yeah, they may come in and get trapped, scurry around, and then find that, look in this house, drippy faucet, source of water, you know, pizza crumbs on the floor. I mean, you got to hand it to any animal. It's going to take the path of least resistance. And if you're offering what it needs and what it wants, it's going to take up resonance with you.
Right. Okay. Actually, we have Greg on the line from Chapel Hill who has a question about hissing cockroaches. Hi, Greg.
Hi. My fiance had actually seen hissing cockroaches at that CSI exhibit at the Natural History Museum, and so she got some, and they may even be pregnant females at this point, so we may have an expanding colony of roaches in our apartment. And I was wondering, I know that there's that they shed hairs, that if you handle them frequently that they can cause a skin rash, and I'm wondering, given the association with European roaches and potentially as a source of asthma, I'm wondering, are there other issues in terms of our health that we need to be concerned about in having a roach colony?
Now, when you have a roach colony, do you have this in a contained place?
Yeah, so these hissing cockroaches, I guess, have a slightly different reproductive style, so they're not laying eggs everywhere. They have sort of an egg sac, and they can be contained, and they're also a little bit more vulnerable to changes in temperature. So I've been assured by her that they're supposed to be contained and they're not going to be infesting our apartment.
You might want a prenup agreement on that.
Yeah.
No, they should not be able to infest. They actually are kind of an interesting animal from the standpoint, you know, we view most roaches as a pest. In nature, Madagascar and hissing cockroaches are actually threatened. They're endangered, special concern.
Is this what you have right here to your
left?
I
do. I have some with me
now. Can you make it hiss again for us? Bring it close to the microphone there if you could. Ooh. Okay.
Of course, the one I pick up quits hissing.
He's got stage fright. Okay, there they go.
Yeah,
That's great. And they make that sound when they are picked up, when they're disturbed? Or
when they're disturbed. Okay. It's actually a sound that's made when they're stressed or disturbed.
And we should I should say that these are much, much larger than the cockroaches that people may have seen. I mean, a palmetto bug doesn't come close in size to this. You could probably put a leash on this one.
No, right? Absolutely. And as far as his concern about them establishing in the house, like I said, there's no real element of concern with that. Typically what happens, should they escape, they don't persist very long. They tend to desiccate and die. The reproductive strategy is very different. You know, you're talking about the egg sac. In actuality, the female maintains the egg sac inside her body and gives birth to live babies, which is a totally different reproductive strategy than seen in most of the home invading types that leave an ootheca or an egg case. Mm-hmm.
So you can buy these?
They are available in a lot of pet stores.
And there's no concern about this becoming an invasive species in the state?
No.
Because that's one
of the reasons that they are available in the pet trade, mm-hmm. because they have been viewed as safe.
Okay. Well, Greg, I hope that helps for your future happiness there at home. Thank you for your call. 1-877-962-9862. And finally, we'll go to Sue, who's in Chapel Hill. Hi, Sue.
Hello. I have another hummingbird issue, which I'd forgotten about until the praying mantis question popped up earlier. I once rescued a baby hummingbird from a rather large Argiope spider web. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. You know, that spider that writes in its web.
It looks like Frankenstein's scar on the side. Mm-hmm. Yes,
yes. Yes, yes. Actually, somebody a long time ago told me when she was a kid that they used to say, you have to watch those webs because if they write your name, you're going to die.
Oh, God.
So I always look at those very carefully.
More insect phobia here, or spider phobia.
Yeah.
So you have a hummingbird caught in such a web.
Baby hummingbird, and I was out in the yard and I heard this very high-pitched sort of squeaking and being sort of naturally curious, which sometimes is a leads one into trouble, but it led me to this poor baby hummingbird who was in the web, not wrapped or anything, just stuck on the web, and I released it and pulled all the gossamer off it, and it flew away. But would that spider have wrapped it up and eaten it, do you think?
Bill?
I think it's very unlikely. The Argiope is a rather large spider, but a hummingbird tends to present a little bit more of a prey item than that spider would favor. I think it's extremely unlikely. I've even seen them kick things such as June bugs out of their webs. You know, if the insect item is too large and they fear that it's going to tear up the web, maybe I shouldn't use the word fear, but they'll cut it loose.
Well, thank you both for joining us today to talk
thank
about
you.
Bugs.
And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bill Reynolds is curator of the Arthropod Zoo at the North Carolina Museum of Natural History in Raleigh. This year, there'll be the Bug Fest there at the museum on Saturday. It runs from 9 in the morning till 9 at night. And Josie Glausius is author of Buzz, The Intimate Bond Between Humans and Insects. Photographs in this book, very, very large photographs of insects by Volker Steiger. And for today, that is the state of things. Thanks for listening. If you have a comment about the show, our email address is sot@wunc.org. Support for the State of Things comes from listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Melinda Penkava.